Setting up shop.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Setting Up Shop, your favorite podcast that happens to be about setting up a shop and selling things and hopefully enjoying doing it in the process. I'm Dan. I'm a woodturner from the UK. And with me, as always, are my co-hosts, Heidi, a potter from America.
Hello.
And Rasmus, a blacksmith from Norway.
Norway, but yeah, close enough.
It depends where you're from. So this week, this episode, we are going to be talking about purposeful marketing, something which, if you've managed to find our Instagram page, website, and any of the other ways we're supposed to be talking about ourselves, you'd imagine is massively lacking in our expertise and areas of knowledge. And you'd be wrong. It's just that we've been incredibly lazy, or more specifically, I've been incredibly lazy, and I have not prioritized doing any of our own things. Hopefully that will have changed by the time this episode comes out. In the meantime, we're going to discuss a couple of things. We're going to break it down into sections. We're going to talk about marketing for events, marketing to liquidate stock or assets, and marketing for growth as well. So it should be an interesting topic. We have some anecdotal evidence. We have some current situations going on, particularly with Erasmus. And we can just have some good old chats about this, which will hopefully be both helpful and entertaining. Although for some reason, this episode, I seem to put the wrong teeth in. So it may well go completely astray, and we'll wait and see what happens.
Oh, Lord.
He can't help you. First of all, marketing for an event. We're going to talk about the fact that Erasmus, at the time of this recording, is it tomorrow your event, Rasmus?
Yes.
You say, I was only half listening in the pre-show chat. Sorry, I was scribbling notes and thinking about cheese. We have got, or you've got, an event happening tomorrow, which you've only done once before, if I remember rightly.
Yes.
And that is, he has got his now soon-to-be biannual, annual, twice-a-yearly open day at his forge, has the doors open and invites people to come round, maybe have a go at forging, and see his stuff, see what he's about, and just kind of, I don't know, I may be making this all up. What is the event about, Raz? Why don't you tell us?
Well, it's a fair bit of that. From doing a lot of teaching, I've ever so often have students ask me, like, oh, this is really fun, where can we do this more often? And kind of I just have to be shruggy and go, like, I don't fully know. I mean, I have this space, but I am often busy on the weekends. But every now and again, I manage to sort of find the weekend here and there. And granted, this is now only the second time, but I'm then able to invite people in and go, like, hey, if you want to work on something of your own, this is your opportunity. Now we can do that. And then I also open it up to the local community and hoping that maybe I get some other people interested in the craft. Maybe they have a go, or even better, they just show up and want to buy things from me, especially now that we are approaching Christmas.
Okay. So is this isn't an extension then of you? This is almost, in effect, you offering it as a turn up, make a project kind of space for those people who maybe don't have the space at home, haven't got the budget yet to set themselves up at home. Would that sound a bit more accurate?
Yeah, I have been wanting to, and I still dream of having enough of a space, and maybe as a part of that, a permanent teaching studio where I can consistently invite or have people show up and work on their own things and not sort of interfere with my space and what I need to get done. And if I were able to have like a dedicated teaching space, that'd be excellent. Like, they can just be in that room, like, scream if you're dying, but otherwise you're kind of on your own, or you can come and ask me for help in between, but I'm here doing my thing. But then I haven't had like the physical space enough to have that separation, especially if I'm supposed to be welding things. Like, I will just, you can't be another person in the room because either the welding glare will get you or all of the fumes will after a while, even though I have a breathing mask on and there's a fan on, but it still kind of fills the room after a bit. So it's one of those, I want this to be a permanent thing in the future, but I don't have the space, but I can do a little bit of something.
Yes. Yeah, no, that makes sense. And you're fortunate enough that you have a reasonable enough sized space that you could have people in there at any one moment in time. So from this point of view then, how have you marketed for this event? Because the initial one, I believe you said, was requested. So from a you know the demands there. So how have you then marketed it?
I've mentioned it in my newsletter, I believe twice. and done a few stories and posts on it, both in like the local Facebook groups and national Facebook groups like that is relevant, and on my own personal sites. So it's not something I've been pushing heavily for a long time. It's a couple of posts here and there, a couple of mentions. Because another factor is, even last time this summer, I think there was a total of 25 people that stopped by, and we had like four or five people that was forging, and a couple more that spent the majority of their day just hanging out, and the forge was full. And also because the space is the way it is, it quickly gets loud. So if you are more people, it gets difficult to have a conversation. So my ambitions here also, like, I don't necessarily want there to be like 100 people stopping by. If I get 30 people that are sort of showing up intermittently throughout the day, that will be perfect, kind of.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And I think it's certainly worth noting for this particular type of event, you're full-time doing this. You've got a physical place that you go to. It's set up for your production work and for everything you're doing. So, and then knowing you like we do, there's a good chance that you'd be in there on a Saturday at some point anyway, if you've got projects on and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So to say, hey, I've got an open day. It's between whatever hours, let's say 10 and 4. I'll be in the shop, pop round. If no one turns up, that doesn't actually necessarily affect you in a negative way. So there's not really a downside from the point of view of you've spent too much money on anything. Because like you said, all of the things you've described, you've got a mailing list. So in actual fact, this has been good because it's some content to mail out, which can be hard to produce sometimes, although you probably find it a bit easier than us because you've got in the rhythm of doing it. You've not had to do any paid marketing in the sense of local Facebook groups, you know, a curated audience through your mail out, and you don't want a high number of figures of people turning up. It's not like attending a market where you've got 400 items to sell. So if one person turns up, they've got to have a really big wallet and want a lot of duplications. So it's not about the numbers as much as it is about it's the quality over quantity. That's probably what I'm trying to get to. Would that sound fair?
Yes. Yes, pretty much. And I am hoping to sell some stuff. But for this event mostly, that's not really the focus. It is more of trying to build more of that community around blacksmithing, and also me just practicing having other people working in my space.
I really like that this event is also in and of itself a marketing tool, because it's opening it up to say, like, you're not obligated to spend anything. Mm-hmm. You're not even obligated to have to try it. You can just come and see what it's about, and you can meet me as a person and see what I'm about. And, you know, that's a lot different than having, you know, some of the things that Dan was describing of like having expenses where you're putting out food and beverage and you've hired a DJ or those kind of things to make it more of like a ruckus event. It's more the event itself is a marketing tool. And I think that's super beneficial that you're not really sinking a ton of money into it, because there's not really money to be had out of it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a nice event to, like you said, build community, test your space, test yourself. I think that's really great. And there's like a no lose situation, because if no one comes, you're going to be there anyway, like Dan was saying, and you can just get to work. But, you know, I think it's brilliant. And it's really nice that you have the space to be able to just do that and figure out like, hey, you know, this weekend I can put my orders to the side and kind of like just play. We talked about that too, like making sure that you're making time to enjoy your space.
Yeah.
I think it's quite disturbing that the more and more that we record these episodes and spend time together, we realize how much of a secret evil genius Rasmus is when it comes to his business. And the jealousy is strong. Certainly for myself, I'm not speaking for Heidi there at all.
Only thing I'm missing is the volcano lair.
That's the only thing you're not inviting people to, is the volcano lair. Well, you've got to power your forge somehow.
We're just not supposed to know about it, Dan.
Yeah, it's cheaper than the gas. I was going to ask, because you make some interesting points there, Heidi. So as he was originally describing the event, because of the way my mind works, although it's like, it's a really low barrier to entry, as you said, there's no, realistically, for people to show up, they've got to have the time and they've got to live close enough and want to go. Like, they don't have to do anything. They literally just turn and go, oh, this is what a modern blacksmith shop looks like. That's kind of cool. Have a brief chat. that's it. There's no, you know, and that's still counted as a, hey, someone showed up, that's nice kind of thing. In my head, I was sort of thinking like, oh, I'd be wanting to have like an axe throwing range outside. I'd be wanting to like, you know, oh, maybe, you know, like it's 10 till 3 and then we go to a bar nearby that I, you know, I would already be over-planning over-developing this event. Or
there are two secret things that I haven't mentioned.
Okay.
So one is I have been toying with the idea for a long while that when I shut off the big gas forge, for how long can I probably cook a pizza in there or multiple pizzas afterwards? Okay. So that's something I plan to try tomorrow. And also, previous weekend, I had a lad in for what ended up being a private Damascus forging class. Private because he showed up, which was excellent because then I had more time to forge more pieces of Damascus myself. But because he's a super nerdy student, he has been playing around with making rubies, which is apparently super easy. You just need the whatever aluminum compounds and something that makes it red. I don't recall the exact composition of things. And then 2,000 something degrees, centigrade, that is. Okay. And then he looked over and saw I had oxyacetylene. And he was like, oh, how hot does that burn? I was like, 3,000 maybe? And he's like, oh, that's hot enough. Do you want to make rubies? I was like, what? So he said he was going to show up on Saturday, tomorrow. If he does, he will bring equipment. And the only thing I need is to have my oxyacetylene. And if that works out, and maybe cameras running. And then maybe we can make rubies. He has currently made like tiny ones that are a third of a carat and only using solar power. So he's used a massive lens to focus the sun whenever we see that in Norway, which is during summer and once or twice.
That's why they've been tiny rubies.
Yes, exactly. So yes, Dan, I also want to do a little bit something extra. And the first time this summer, I made waffles. That was fun. That felt excellent. Yeah. Now I'm stepping it up a little bit by rubies and pizza, maybe.
See, what I like about that is, though, is that I'm assuming you've not advertised either of those facts on the invite.
I have mentioned that maybe we will try to make pizza at the gas forge.
Yeah. So what I'm liking about that, though, is the fact that, as Heidi said just now, you're embracing the play aspect. You're kind of going, hey, do you know what? This is just a cool time where, if people want to come and try some nerdy stuff, or people want to just come and have, like, you know, fortified pizza TM, that it would be great. It would just be that thing of, it's just a cool event. It's like something that happens once, maybe twice a year, and you do your thing, and then people can show up if they want to. Because what I was actually going to suggest, and having an ulterior motive here, is that maybe what you should do for the next one is actually advertise, I will have anvils for sale and tongs for sale and vices for sale, and get that stuff out of storage if it's still there and cleaned up and pre-priced up and ready, or even packaged up of, hey, you know, leg vice, anvil and set of tongs for X price kind of thing. So you've got people who will come for the open forgy bit, but you've also got people who will come because they just want to buy the thing and then go, oh, you mean you are actually a blacksmith? This isn't just a selling thing. And
okay,
this
we can go a bit deeper into that, sort of how I have dialed in the marketing, because we have the local Facebook group just for that area of Oslo that I've advertised more generally, saying the forge will be open. Stop by if you just want to have a look, or if you want to try blacksmithing. If you want to get a head start in Christmas gifts, that would be excellent. We have hand-forged goodies, kind of. That's like the extent and tone of my marketing message to them. There's other then three other Facebook groups that I will market to depending on what I have for sale. One is the blacksmithing group, where I have mentioned anvils, leg vices, and the firebricks. I don't have hand tools or tongs for sale at the moment, although I occasionally sell to the students because I can easily make extra. I just haven't made enough for it to be a regular thing. But like also like sticks of steel, materials, whatever, all of that. Then I have like 70 axes now currently in boxes. That is, even for me, a bit more than I need. So one of the things I was hoping to do, and I haven't had the time for, is to de-rest all of them, take some pictures, and post that to a national axe group and say, hey, I will have an open forge day. I will have these axes available for sale. Please come by and say hello. And that would be the extent of marketing to that group. And then there's the knife making community that also has it's a couple of groups. There's one big one for like custom and handmade knives. Granted, again, I haven't had the time to make a lot of finished knives with handles and sheaths, and I also haven't had the time to forge up a new batch of knife blades. But if I did, I would then also do a post in that group and say, hey, here's what I have for sale now, open forge day. And it's kind of low key. It's just inviting people and mentioning I'm here so that those people in these specific communities, I have something that might motivate them to travel a bit further. But for a local group, it's just like, if you happen to walk by, it would be nice to stop by.
So it's a slight twist on the event, and it moves nicely into the topic about marketing to liquidate.
Yes, as well.
which what we mean by that is pretty much as Rasmus has said, you know, selling off excess stock, coming to the realization that that beautiful stuff that you have hoarded, you're not actually going to be able to do with stuff with that for the whole time. So that is the equivalent of me, for all those woodturners listening out there, and I know there's at least two, that is the equivalent of me opening my wood store and actually admitting that those planks of heavily rippled timber are not going to become anything, and that I should sell them, and that I will open my workshop for people to come in and you know, come to a wood sale, come and buy some blanks, come and buy some whatever. But also we can have the lathe running and people can come and have a good time. I seem to remember in the past, Heidi, that we don't, am I right in thinking that you don't do a second sale?
I do not.
Mm-hmm. No. But it is something that some people might, you know, some people will keep items that they will class as a second that you or I might look at and go, well, it's, you know, I would not have noticed that if you hadn't pointed it out, depending on what the product is. I burn mine. Very destructive. Whereas Raz smashes and burns his, and then it becomes something.
Yeah, very therapeutic.
Yeah, that's why you're most cheerful one out of the three.
Or it's just because it is my full-time job and it's not yours yet.
Well, there's entirely that possibility as well. I think it's a very different thing, isn't it? Because if you were going to market a liquidation of stock sale, probably not the right words to use, because it sounds like you're closing up and you're desperate for money or you've gone bankrupt. But it's much more about you need room.
Mm.
You know, you need the space, because that space might be what's stopping you from developing the next step, or it's hindering your production process. Or it's just getting you down. It can really affect your mental space. If, like, having been to Rasmus's workshop, when you step into the workshop, it's just not like open the door and stroll in. There is literally a step into the workshop.
Yeah.
And if something was in just the wrong place that you bashed your shin against it every morning when you walked in, but there was also no room to put it somewhere else, that would be quite frustrating over a long period of time. And that would probably be the first thing on my list to go on. Right, well, this needs to be sold, and, you know, moving things on. I once had a number of items that I got from buying up someone's old workshop. And one of them was a gorgeous 1950s or 60s air compressor. And it was specifically for airbrushes for cars.
Ooh.
And so it was a low pressure air compressor, but it was a lovely yellow tank that was on its own, like, red trolley, and it was like, had the retro kind of look to it. Rusted to hell, very little of original paint left. Hoses pretty much perished on it and everything else. I'm a wood turner. I don't play with color. I've never airbrushed. It's not a thing I ever want to do, but I had this thing in my shop for like 8 months, and it was in the way, but it was on wheels, so it was okay. I kept moving it out of the way. And I was determined that I was going to either give it to someone who was going to make use of it, but the people I offered it to weren't really interested. They already had kit, which is fair enough. And I ended up giving it away, despite the fact that I still feel it had value to it that, you know, the right person would have paid for. But it was just in my way in the end. And it was just that thing where I suddenly had that wake-up moment, and I realized I was keeping a lot of things because they were cool, which is fine if you've got space and they don't hinder your development and your work and everything else. So I think there's definitely an element of a reality check when it comes to selling the excess stock. Like you said, Rasmus, you know, you've got 70 axes. And you might not have realized you had that many until at one point you suddenly went, hang on a minute, I've got a box over there, and then there's a bucket of some there. And then I'm just going to count. I've probably got 30. And then by the time you got to 50, you were like, hang on a minute. Like, how many do I actually have here? And how many of these are actually worth anything? and all of
yeah,
that.
Yeah,
kind of
it's been a few moments of, oh, there's this, like a small local auction of like a lot of axes.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are beat up, but I can probably fix them. And I get them for like 10 quid each or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's like, cool. And then you do that for a few years and you pass on a few, you sell a couple here, and then suddenly you still have like just a lot of them. And yeah. It's like, oh, right. And now space is becoming a premium. Yeah. And I don't really chop wood that often. And I want to move on to make more axes for myself. So like, I actually have a surplus of axes at this point.
Yeah. What would you class as something that you would move on, Heidi? Is there like a particular pattern or design, or is it something you would do?
Yeah, I mean, like seasonally, I make specific things that are Halloween or Christmas or just like harvest. So like maybe at the end of that season, I don't want, like maybe I didn't sell well or I made too many because I thought that I'd sell more. I would possibly do something like just a quick QR code, you know, discount. Like you click on this QR code, you get a discount code, and then you can go on my website and purchase it at like, you know, 50%, something right. Like that.
You do quite a hefty discount then.
Yeah. Yeah. Or in some cases, it's I have to make excess of orders. So, say like a coffee company comes to me and says, I want 100 pieces. I have to make at least like 10 extra, if not more, depending on the complexity of the piece to make sure, you know, it survives all the way through the entire process. So I might be left with the entire allotment of items that I had made as a just in case. And then I've got this like just random bundle of a bunch of different local coffee shop mugs. And I'm like, well, I need to get rid of them somehow. And, you know, some places they accept donations, you know, around the holidays, they'll like resell stuff like a Goodwill kind of situation.
Yeah.
But in other ways, like I will just take them to work and put them on a table and say like free to whomever. Mm-hmm. I don't feel right about taking someone else's like logo and reselling it.
Yeah.
On my shop or anything, but I will, you know, give those things away as long as, you know, they're still functional. But I remember a time that I made a bunch of apple bakers. I just really liked making them. And that was a me problem. They were just really fun to make. They're a bowl with a spike in the middle.
Yeah.
And you core an apple, you put it on the bowl, and then you put it in the oven. And you like put cinnamon and sugar on top of the apple. And it makes it like it's a crustless apple pie, basically. Mm. And I know they're super cool. Like a lot of people really like them, but as a sellable item, like most people don't want a piece of pottery that they can't use daily or like, you know, it's just hard to store. So I made way too many of them. And then I was just like, okay, well, you know, they're taking up so much space because they are bowls and they have this spiky thing, so they can't stack. Mm. So that like storage wise, they're just a pain in the butt. So I did like the discount code situation. I got rid of a good number of them. So I still have had a few, you know, on my table. And then I just had like it wasn't a seconds table. It was just like a discontinuing table and where, you know, I offered the same deal or I did like a twofer, like a BOGO kind of situation. And I got rid of them all. And then I got obsessed with making batter bowls.
I'm sensing a trend here.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, like when, I don't know if you guys are like this, but like when you find this new technique.
No, not at all.
Never happened.
And then you just want to keep doing the technique until, you know.
Yeah. I know completely when to move on and not, you know, and I never use it to procrastinate from doing paid work that I've got a time limit on at all. Never happens.
Yeah. So that was my next thing that I like made way too many of because I was just like super excited for this new thing. And I think the next thing is going to be these bacon cookers that you put in the microwave. They're basically like a bowl with a tall cylinder with kind of a wavy rim. And then you drape the bacon over and then you put it in the microwave oven and all of the grease flows down into the catch basin.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But it makes perfect bacon. And I know that that's going to be the next thing that I get obsessed over. So like I'll do a run of prototypes just until I can really perfect the form and understand how I need to glaze it and everything. So although they're not seconds, they are prototypes. So I might do like a prototype sale, Like, hey, you know, these aren't exactly where they ended up. Maybe I decided to change the glaze or whatever, but like there's a limited number of these that aren't perfected. So that would be another liquidation. So there's the stuff that's like overstocked where I got a little too crazy with batter bowls and apple bakers. And then there's the prototype lot, which I just explained. And then there's the overflow from, you know, making preemptive pieces to make sure that I can fulfill an order. But as far as like pottery equipment, like what Rasmus has for the blacksmith, I don't have any extra equipment. I don't hoard it. I don't like get offered it, at least not right now. So like, it's not a concern that I have, but I can imagine if I were in a space where there wasn't a local supply company, that I would feel tempted to become that supplier. Like I would sell glaze. Like I would buy truckloads of bulk.
Yeah.
Have a storage facility. Yeah. Then I get the discount, but then I can also resell to other local people. Fortunately for where I am, I'm in the city and we have a local clay manufacturer that also sells kilns and wheels and all of those things. But if I were in a remote location, say like up north where I'm from, I would be tempted to just rent storage space to be able to resell equipment or wholesale equipment to the schools and that kind of thing.
It's a very tempting thing because not only is it an extra revenue stream, but it's also, it's easier. Like in the sense that it's not your product that you've put your heart and soul and time into. It's, if you're sensible about it, it's a known brand, it's a known product, it's a known commodity, whatever you want to call it. Like, you know, I would resell clay or I would resell glaze. Well, if you're a potter in that area and you can't get it from anywhere else, and actually the price isn't too dissimilar, then why wouldn't you buy it from someone who's local to you who might be selling it out of a unit rather than from a shop? Rather than you, I'm going to set up a shop, and but it's all going to be tools that I have designed and manufactured and I want to get my name out there. You know, it's a whole other business. Whereas, you know, one of the things that I've done a number of times in the past, I'm sure I've mentioned, is unfortunately some wood turners have gone to the big lathe in the sky. Their families don't want and have no idea what to do with the stuff left behind. So I've offered reasonable money, given, you know, time to move it, and then the fact that there might be some stuff I will use, but more likely I'm going to be selling it or giving it to people who may or may not need it. And that's fine, but that's potentially a whole other business. Now all of a sudden you're in a secondhand tool business or secondhand machinery business. You've got to know how to clean it, where to clean it, what the value is, how to repair it. Can you still get spares? If it's electrical, are you willing to pat test it, maybe offer some form of warranty? Do you have to? What are the legal wranglings of your country? And then again, you're back into the marketing element of it, is how do you sell it?
Yeah.
You know, 2 years ago when I was doing a lot of that, Facebook Marketplace, fantastic. You know, you list a machine or an item on there, within an hour, you would have had 10 responses from people, three of whom were serious, and you could have conversations. And within 2 days, maybe 3 days, maybe a week tops, you'd sold whatever you'd done. And it was all down to take a good photo, put a proper description in there with the correct keywords, make it clear you know what you're talking about, make it really obvious what you expect, where it is, you know, where is it, what is it, when is it available, how much is it, and all that kind of stuff. And you could make reasonable turnover. Wouldn't necessarily say a living out of it, you'd have to work really hard for that, but you could make reasonable turnover out of it. But the problem is things change. And this is where, you know, we turn back to the marketing element of it. And all of a sudden, you know, legislation changes in different countries. I don't know about you guys, but buying things on Facebook Marketplace is easier. Selling is not so much. Like, it definitely feels like it's a buyer's market out there at the moment, because I don't know whether it's that there's too much on there, or certainly in the UK, there's hints of legislation coming in where they're going to potentially be able to track, I can't remember exactly what it was based on, but it's something to do with they're going to be able to track the flow of money based through social media so that they can make sure that people aren't literally evading tax by selling things purely through social media places, platforms, which makes sense from, you know, from a government standpoint, but has put a lot of people off, you know, put a lot of people off from selling on there. So if you know, whatever it was you are trying to move along, selling things to sell it quickly, to make space and to make room, if it's not individual, like you guys have been saying, you know, whether it's you've got your own workshop and you go, oh, I've got an excess of this, but I know there's some specialist local groups who will come and buy, and, you know, or like yourself, Heidi, you know, well, I'll just do a QR code. As long as I cover the costs of my materials, then actually, you know, it's been valuable because I've got practice in and I've moved things along. You know, the toss up to that is, certainly for you and myself, Heidi, is our shops are at our houses.
Yeah.
You know, so you don't want to say, hey, come on, come all, come along. It's an open, you know, whatever. It's like, no. Actually, I'm very particular about who knows exactly where I'm based and who comes along to the workshop and all that kind of stuff. So it can make it a bit harder if you're going to have a, you know, you don't want people to think that you're selling up the house or you're having a yard sale or like you know, garage clear out, offer me a pound for everything and then we're good. You know, it's not like that. Mm-hmm. Trying to move things on. Speaking of moving on then, if we go on to our final of our three-prong attack on marketing for today, marketing for growth. And I think this is probably the hardest one because I think this one is the one that's got to be, it's got the trickiest goal association with it. If it's, you know, everything really has to have a goal oriented to it. And so when you say growth, you know, it's growth of what? Are you trying to grow the average number of sales per month, grow the average number of spend per month? Are you trying to grow the number of people on your mailing list? Are you trying to grow the number of followers on social media? All of which have their own sort of little idiosyncrasies and kind of things about it. But the main element of it that I kept coming back to in my mind was getting your storytelling right. And what I mean by that specifically isn't that you are making things up, but the story of you and your journey and your brand or your business and what you're doing and being consistent with it. Or if you're not consistent, you know, if you're having a major shift, explaining why there's a major shift, not just doing it and expecting people who have been with you from the beginning to be still happy about it and continue with that journey. But also being honest in the sense of, there's definitely a quality over quantity thing again, isn't it? It's that element of, you know, having 100 people subscribe to your newsletter who actually read every letter, who actually pay attention to everything you do, rather than having 1,000 people who subscribe to it, but only 5 of them open it. What are your thoughts on that, guys? I know we've covered some of this before, but as the master of the newsletter there, Rasmus, what would your what would you offer out on the marketing for growth element? Like, have you ever consciously gone out and tried to grow the numbers for your newsletter?
Yes, I have. It depends, though. I don't tend to focus on growing anything specifically, aside from trying to be consistent about what I'm posting, like consistent quality and consistent message in that sense, and also vaguely consistent on the timing of it. My newsletter, sometimes it goes 2-3 months before I send out something. Other times I try to send out every single month. If there's something big, I might pay extra because of the plan I got and push out an extra one just a couple of weeks after, but that's pretty rare.
Yeah.
More often than not, I try to only say something when I have something to say, but I try to find something good to say as often as possible.
Yeah.
So it's not what we talked about earlier, but like you shouldn't post things or say something just to fill the air.
Yeah.
You should have something concrete to show, but every once in a while, that thing, at least in my business, it seems like a lot of people just find it fascinating to see what I am working on and maybe some thoughts about why I'm doing specifically this thing. So if I'm working on like on a couple of knives, it's like, okay, here's what I've been focusing on in the production of these knives. I've been trying to use this tool or trying to figure out this technique a bit better. Or like last time I made a shit ton of knives, it was just, I need practice doing this on the power hammer. I need to figure out how I can use the power hammer better and more efficiently. And I just posted a couple of pictures and I showed a bit of that.
Okay. Can I had a thought about this the other day, and this will sound like a potentially very stupid question. Mm-hmm. So I used Squarespace currently for my website, and yeah, I paid for the newsletter add-on, and then true to form didn't do anything with it. And I've subsequently canceled the newsletter add-on, because I didn't drive enough on there. I think I ended up with about 12 people subscribed to it, which is fine. But I think I might have sent one newsletter in about 8 months. So it was a waste of money from that perspective.
Yes.
Have either of you ever considered just sending emails from like a Gmail account that you already have? And just literally, so you can still sort of harvest, which always sounds like a horrible word, harvest, you know, the data in the sense of the email addresses, but just not paying, not having that cost of the monthly payout for whether or not you're using a built-in service like Squarespace or whether you're paying for MailChimp or something like that. Because then your restriction is only a limitation of software, but you can create a newsletter picture in effect or whatever. You know, there are clever ways of doing things and then just putting it in an email.
I think Gmail allows for a certain amount of HTML coding as well, so you can make it look pretty nice. I do that sometimes because of how I'm interact with customers in different ways. Whenever I need to talk to or want to get feedback on the classes or thoughts on future classes, or maybe I'm saying, hey, I know you signed up for a basic class a while back. Now we offer these slightly more advanced classes or different classes. I'm sending that from my Gmail account directly.
Yeah.
Granted, that still comes from the same domain as my marketing emails and my website.
Yeah, I was going to ask that. Doesn't it arrive from the same email address either way?
So to some extent, it will look the same to people, but the formatting will be clearly different. Like, and I kind of like that. Like, this is the marketing email for everybody, and this is the pure text, the simple version. I'm talking here to you because I want your feedback and your thoughts.
Yeah,
I might mention in the email that I'm sending this to you now because you took a class. You're part of this group of people.
Hmm.
But I'm trying to make it a bit different. And also because of how I am harvesting the emails for my general newsletter, a lot of those people are just customers that stop by the website and they just click sign up for the newsletter. Hmm. And then they are not dedicated or motivated enough to open the newsletter when I get it. Yeah. So the last few newsletters, the open percentage have been dropping a fair bit because more and more people have signed up for the newsletter just through the checkout.
Okay, so that's the element that was missing that I hadn't thought about is the metrics.
Mm-hmm.
If you're literally just emailing out from Gmail while it's cheaper, you have nothing to tell you how many people have actually opened that.
Yeah.
And whether or not they've got a click-through rate or anything like that. So that's realistically what you're paying for. So
yeah,
hopefully even that on its own has been valuable to some people listening in. Because I was genuinely sat there going like, hang on a minute, why would I be paying X amount per month for software that I've got to then learn how to use? I'm not a technophobe, but I don't use it enough to be good with it. I could write and I can put pictures and I can do whatever in an email. I can still blind copy people in so that people don't, you know, there's no data violation on sharing other people's email addresses. It's a cost saving, but the trade-off to that cost saving is the fact that you have absolutely no idea if people are actually opening and reading that data. So you're in effect screaming into the void and hoping that something's going to answer you back.
Yes, even though that sounds slightly disturbing now.
Well, you know, undercurrent of anger through everything I do, what can I say?
Yeah, but just on the whole analytics thing. So from my most recent newsletter, I sent out and delivered 440 new emails. 136 opened them and 25 clicked on something. Out of those 25, 11 of them clicked on the Axe class I will be having Joe of Thornwood Forge over for in February.
Nice.
And that clearly tells me that, oh, I hit something here. People are interested in this. And
it's called Handsome Joe is what they're interested in, Raz. You're using, you know, certain things to sell product here. You've got to be careful.
I didn't put his face in the newsletter, though. Maybe I should have. Maybe that would double the rate there. But so I can just quickly then see like, okay, but the open rate, I get nearly a third. That seems all right.
Hmm.
And out of them, a fifth is clicking on something. That means that, okay, there's at least 25 people who spent a fair amount of time reading most of what I wrote, I imagine. And then I can look through the analytics and I can see like which of the links did people click on. And I can see like, okay, this thing seems to be resonating with people to some extent. And that helps. It doesn't give me anything concrete, but I feel like it helps tell me about what people find interesting about the thing I wrote.
Do you find, Heidi, from the point of view, we're focusing again on, you know, we're trying to do growth. Let's say we're trying to aim for growth of numbers on social media, which is in some ways a ridiculous statistic because we know that there are quite a few tricks for doing that, but I'm trying to think of what's the term? I want to call it like green acre content. That's not the term.
It's evergreen
something. Evergreen content. There was a green in there somewhere. Green arrow content, whatever you like. Do you think that seasonality plays much into it? Because you've been really good at like whenever there is a shift to autumn or whatever. I'm not talking about like Halloween, Christmas type stuff, but just the general kind of, hey, now it's summertime, so everything tends to be a lot smileier, bright, cheerful, all of that kind of stuff. Autumn, it's like, okay, we're going for autumnal colors and themes and whatever. I don't know if you monitor that so much, but do you find that there is much of a kind of a growth? Do you, what am I trying to say? Do you target like the specific hashtags, for instance, of like, you know, because you could easily say, oh, look, you know, pumpkin spice latte season type thing, and you've got a mug with it in and whatever, and that's a whole group of people, but they're not necessarily going to be your demographic for buying your mugs.
Yeah.
You can grow the numbers, but you're not growing the evergreen content of the people, which I know is the wrong terminology, but you're not growing that core group of people who actually are likely to become a customer.
I would say, like, when it comes to my newsletters, it's re-engaging with existing customers.
Yeah.
It's reminding them I exist, giving them insight into, maybe they're not on social media, so they're not seeing my stories. So I do regurgitate a lot of the same stuff that I'm posting on social media. I'm taking the best of it, the stuff that had the most engagement, and using that photography in my newsletter. And then usually I do a three-part newsletter. The first part is like, here's just like a gist of what's been happening this quarter. And then the next part is maybe showcasing a new product or something I've been working on. So then I've got the social media clips in there and links to that so that people can see the stories if they are interested. And then the third part might be like what's to come, so that people that maybe aren't engaged with me on social media might feel inclined to follow the story of what's going on or join a live or, you know, those kind of things. So the purpose for my newsletter is more re-engagement of existing customers. When I talk about growth marketing, I'm looking for people that either have never heard of me before or didn't realize that I offered some things other than my website catalog, right? Okay. So when I look at growth, right now I am not promoting the small batch work to new opportunity clientele. I've been relying on word of mouth and the network that I have been serving to keep that, just that part of the business sustainable. Now, looking ahead to if I were to go full-time as a potter, whether that would be my choice or forced, that would be an open area of growth that I would be pursuing because it's the way I like to work. I hate one-offs. Because for potters, there is no such thing as a one-off. You have to make five of the one-off thing. And then you're left with, you know, whatever extra that you have kind of sitting, gaining dust. So, you know, that liquidation conversation.
Yeah.
If I were to be intentional about trying to grow the batch work portion, the wholesale portion of my business, then I would do a lot more targeted marketing to small businesses. I would be more intentional at the holidays to do that as well, to say like, hey, you have clients that you like to give gifts to. What would be the most comforting, warm thing that you could give a client? A bag of coffee and a mug with your logo on it, you know? So like there's that joint opportunity of partnering with a coffee maker, like a brewmaster down the road from me called 19 Coffee Company. I do a lot of work with them. They push my work. I push their work. It's a really good partnership.
Yeah.
They introduce their clients to me. And sometimes like if I'm going to deliver mugs, I might reach out to them and say, hey, do you need me to deliver some coffee? you know, because they're right up the street. But I think if I were looking at marketing for growth, that would be the place where I would need to really look at how do I do that. And to me, that marketing would look like some social media marketing that I would pay for, obviously, that it would reach more people than just are already subscribed to me. I would focus on more hashtags about small business and, you know, partnership and growth. And then additionally, I might go traditional form and see if there are printed newspapers that go to businesses, you know, those kind of catalog flyers that come out that say like, you know, these services are available and be more, again, it really goes back to intentionality. What are you trying to do to grow? What is the most interesting part of that growth that you can tell a story about? And then who is your audience? Once you have those three things figured out, you can build your marketing material or your collateral to fit those things, i.e., you know, printed postcards with your body of work on it that you can either mail out or hand out. For me, that's, you know, dropping off a stack of cards at a local coffee shop that I might sell my work at and say like, hey, you know, consider this as like your wholesale gift buying opportunity. And then there's the idea of, you know, growth through product itself and not so much the sales channel. Mm. Like for me, seasonally, I might want to make the bacon makers, the bacon makers. So what I would do probably to just see if there's an audience for it is just send that in my newsletter, make a post on my Instagram, make a post on YouTube of how I make it, how it's used, maybe like an instructional video that I can, you know, make a card that goes with the product. And then when it gets gifted, then people get introduced to, you know, my world and what I'm doing. And then they follow along for like, you know, it's every touch point is an opportunity for marketing. Yeah. Your packaging, your placards, your mailers, all of those things can turn into an opportunity. And it's really, growth is about being intentional.
Yeah. I had an order on my website within the last couple of weeks and I had the stock, so that wasn't a problem. I sort of refinished them because I wasn't entirely happy with the finish on them, but I was in a rush and I packaged them so that, I mean, they'll be safely distributed and delivered. But I knew as I handed the packaging over to a colleague of mine to do like the final stage and get it sent on, I knew I wasn't happy with the way they were packaged.
Hmm.
Like, there's nothing wrong with it. They're wrapped in bubble wrap. They've got tissue paper around them. There's a thank you card in there with a handwritten note. But I wasn't happy with the package. And it's still gone out. The customers had it. I've not had any negative feedback. I've not had any positive feedback either. But there was just that little element, like you said, there's that touch point where you know this is an opportunity for marketing. And in my heart, I'm pretty sure that what that package said, I was in a rush. I didn't care as much about this as I could have done. That probably is me overthinking it. But it's also that element of wanting to tell the story right. Wanting it to be that as soon as someone opens that outer layer of packaging, they feel like this is a quality item that was worth the money that they paid for it. This is definitely handcrafted. This is not just another Temu buy that someone's shipped onto them. And I think that element of the storytelling and all of that kind of stuff is definitely important. This is not something I've done, not necessarily I was even considering doing, but I think we're all aware of people in the past who are, they're probably more on the social media side of stuff or on the YouTube side of stuff, which is absolutely fine. Like that's the way they make their business, their money and everything else. But I'm aware of one of them who a number of years ago, I can't remember the original basis of it, but they made a product and they made X number of said product. And I think, and I might be getting it wrong, but they were making that product in order to get better at making that specific thing. That in order to have the drive to do so, in order to fund them doing it and buy the materials and whatever, they basically pre-sold 50 of that item to their viewership and said, hey, look, these are going to be my practice ones. Like, you know, they're going to be made to the best of my ability at that point in time, but I'm not going to do it so that person number one gets hammer number one or whatever the item may be, you know, whether it was a bowl or whatever. They would just jumble them up so that you can't see that, well, I got the one that was rubbish, whereas compared to number 50, which was a lot better. Does that feel too gimmicky? Does that feel, I mean, certainly from your point of view, Heidi, and I think from mine as well, it's like you've not got time to do that much practice and development on that kind of thing because it's, you know, we do a lot more commission-based work or prepping stuff for a market and it all needs to be at a certain quality already. But I was just thinking about it then as an interesting way to tell a story and to, if you've already got a good base, you know, you mentioned earlier, Rasmus, that you want to make a load of axes. Now let's say this is your first time of making a load of axes. You know, you could prelim do a newsletter out to your good customer base who want to buy finished product from you and say, hey guys, you know, I'm doing my next stage for my personal development. This is what I want to do. And you can talk all about the history, whether it's going to be a Swedish pattern or whatever, you know, long beard, all that kind of stuff. You know, you could have a vote, see which pattern people would vote for thinking that would be the best one. And you could then write, okay, so this is the one that's won the vote. X amount of people entered the vote, so I'm going to make X amount. but I'm going to give you guys the first opportunity to buy them. Does, you know, is that something that is too specific, is too kind of, do you see what I'm getting at? Because it can feel gimmicky. And I'm just trying to break past that barrier, as we've discussed in previous episodes, of people restricting themselves to certain ways that everyone else is doing, when actually you can just do something when you're in effect saying to people, hey, look, if you prepay for this thing, this will be delivered. Here's the approximate timescale I'm attempting to do these in. You know, you've got to be upfront and honest. Maybe you just take a deposit, whatever. But it's not a Kickstarter. You know, this is the important thing. You're not inventing a brand new product. They're buying into you and kind of whatever. You're not necessarily using it to fund to buy the materials or whatever. It's just kind of that incentive to make you finish the project for that personal growth.
I think it's almost the same as doing a Kickstarter if you are doing something that is very new to you.
Okay.
Because, like, take the example of Axis, because it is a fairly good one. I haven't set up the tooling or my forge enough to know how long it should take me to make an axe using this and this process, using this and this steel. I don't have experience fully yet to know how I should make an axe and still make money, and how to sell it and what price to sell it at and still make money.
Multiple grits, according to Joe's post earlier today.
Yes. I mean, and that is kind of the thing. And I've been working onto that. I mean, problem solving that. I have seen a lot of what he's doing, and I talked about a lot of friends that are making more axes than me. And I need to figure out how to use the power hammer most efficiently and get the shape I want. And I'm problem solving. I don't have the time yet to dedicate like a couple of days in one go and just like, okay, I make an axe with the tooling I have. I notice problems. I make new tools. I make another axe, notice new problems, and go on.
But all of that's part of the story though, isn't it?
It is. So if I were to do this kind of pre-sale thing, it would be very difficult for me to know what to price it at fairly. Because even if they are practice pieces, I will still want them to be as good as possible and as functional as possible. So, and also I can't sell them too cheaply because my times, it is too much of a time sink versus what I make back from it. Right. Yeah. So I'm kind of struggling with this just now, but because there are so many really good axsmiths in Norway, I don't want to start selling something and say this is a practice run.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't have a following where I can say, okay, I want to do a practice run of axes. It's going to be, and I need to make 10 or 20 to sort of break even and figure out a system. I don't have the following to guarantee I can sell all of those 20s or something and do it within a limit where I break even and be guaranteed of that. That's sort of where my mind goes, because I haven't figured everything out and I don't have the audience to guarantee that will go well.
See, I was thinking of it more of a almost generating a hype and then potential for growth of it attracting people, you know, because we were talking about
marketing. Then I would just tell the story and skip all the money part and just like, I made this axe, now it's for sale.
That's not fulfilling the whole. So from my point of view as a consumer, that would be me.
Let me rephrase.
No. What I mean is like you telling the story of it and kind of, oh, you know, and this is what happened. Even if you're doing it as a daily update, I'm trying to think of his name. Is it Max Randolph, the blacksmith in California? So he tells his story of making the tree or whatever it is he's been making, right? That, you know, right from the get-go, you are never going to physically see that unless you've been fortunate enough to be invited to his workshop during the process of him making it. But the payout for that is seeing it in place and seeing the reveal and knowing that because he's good enough at cinematography and photography, that you're going to get really, really nice. Yeah. It's going to be well presented. It's going to look gorgeous. And you get to see that finished item.
Mm.
But the payout of the story of, you know, you're right. For me, and this is me very much projecting my own personal thoughts and feelings, which is hardly unusual for this podcast, I would want that payout to be, I want to invest in you developing. If you're making, let's say you're making 20 axe heads, and you've come right at the beginning and say, okay, this is the story, and this is me moving on. And it's not because you need the money. It's not because you can't do it unless you've had the money there. But it's you know, it's the whole Kickstarter model. People want to put the money in the things they want to see you succeed. You know, yes, they want the reward from it.
I think that's starting to move into like the difference between being a professional and being an amateur.
Okay.
So if you are not skilled yet in your chosen craft to where it may only take you 10 attempts to like get something that you're like, yeah, this is good. I know my process, I'm going. It might take you 100 attempts to get there. You're more at an amateur level where selling the story and selling your growth is more important than the end product. But if you're a professional and you want to sell a really good quality tool and that's what you're building your name off of, then you're not going to go onto social media and ask for funding to do what you're doing. So it's like really it comes down to where are you at in your journey and what is the quality of your finished good? Does the finished good tell enough of the story that it's a quality product, or are you selling your experience? Like, are you selling your story or are you selling a product?
I think that's actually quote unquote my issue with that model.
That's probably what I was underlying trying to work out. as is always the case, I need to talk everything through and then have a voice of reason. More often than not, it's Heidi.
And then the American comes in and thinks they know everything.
Yeah, no, because I very much like to use the story as a marketing tool.
Yeah.
I want to show that I am human too, that I'm still learning.
I've noticed that every time I've skipped one of your TikTok videos.
Thank you, I think. But yeah, I like to tell the story of why and how I'm making something.
Yeah.
But I don't want to have that be in the same conversation as why I'm selling something.
I like that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really good defining line to have. Yeah, absolutely.
Because I can talk to other people who know enough about the craft and say like, and I have done that with a couple of lives where like, so and people wanted to buy some of my practice pieces. And I was like, no, I'm keeping this one for myself because I like it, despite it being a practice piece. Other times I make a prototype and it's kicking about and then someone comes in. Like what happened a month ago, I had someone who was looking for like a pot hook that was going out from the wall, like a bracket pot hook thing. Make sense? Yeah, I had a prototype kicking around for ages that I made, I guess, as a practice piece, as a demo for a client, and they went with something else. And he was starting to describe something, and I was like, hold on a second. And I went like almost literally over to a bucket, pulled this piece out and say, is this what you're thinking of? And he was like, yes, that's pretty much exactly it. Here you go.
Yeah.
And that's like...
Let me just polish it up for you.
Yeah. Like pretty much like this was untreated. It wasn't in a scrap bucket. It was in a bucket of prototypes. It was in, it looked nicer than that.
Yeah.
But it was exactly one of those things of, okay, I'm more than happy to sell you this thing because it actually solves your issue right here and now.
Yeah.
But if this was going to be a finished product, and I've been thinking about that since, like how would I make this specific style a finished product? Then again, it's the whole development using the power hammer, how to do this nicely and quickly and all of that. But the story of why and how I'm making it, I'd like that to be different from the push of now I'm selling this thing. Because often the people who are interested in the story will often also want to buy the thing and it never regardless. But there's far more people who only wants to buy the thing and doesn't really care about how it came to be.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's just our nerdy world that really likes that.
Okay, I really like that distinction, and I'm glad it was brought to the fore. And the fact that it's your distinction between professional and amateur. It's your distinction between the different groups of people. Some who want to hear the story. I remember Johnny Allen, Irish knife maker. I would put his social media tag out there, but he's got far too many followers anyway. He was very good to me right at the beginning when I asked him advice on.
That doesn't sound like him. I probably shouldn't be kissing him like this, but it's fun.
there's a story there that you may not have heard. He was very good to me right at the beginning when I was starting my Bevelwood page and I was trying to work out the sort of the feel and the tone of the content. And I asked him a few questions about it. And he was very clear at that point in time. So this is a few years ago now and things may have changed. But he said, no one wants to see you make the product on your Bevelwood page. Yeah. Your Bevelwood page is about the pretty picture of the finished product. The people who are buying from you are not the people who want to know how it was made. The people who want to know how it was made are us other nerdy people who make things. Like, you know, we aren't customers, even though some of us may occasionally buy a piece from you. You know, we are friends. We are like-minded people. That's why it's better to have two accounts and you have one where it's all about, like, he said, that doesn't mean you can't have, you know, at the time, reels weren't a thing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when they became a thing, there's nothing wrong with showing like snippets of process, but you're not sat there going, this started out as a piece of tree and then da 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 da, you know. But that was the thing of pretty pictures. Instagram's a magazine. People flick through magazine and go, oh, that's nice. Oh, that's nice. You know, that kind of element of it. That may well have changed. His opinion on that may have changed. I don't know. But I do remember at the time him saying that and me thinking, oh, okay. Because it was a mind shift of going from the fun, vague attempt at YouTubery kind of Instagram page that I'd had before. But it did also mean that unless you... You know, if you want true content, if you want true followers, it's very difficult to grow that without buying into the trends and following certain things and all that kind of stuff. And I'm not very good at that.
It pains me to say it, but I think he had a really good point. And I think that's the exact opposite situation of all of your followers of woodworkers and then suddenly trying to sell finished products and nothing sells because exactly. All of your followers are able to make the exact same thing.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, I am not doing that. I have only one page because I am very lazy that way. And mostly I'm showing it sort of intermittently. But also, I kind of don't have the capacity to do marketing super well. That sounds weird. I don't have the capacity to do a lot more work anyway without starting to employ someone. So for me to start tailoring and putting my content and putting up a second account only to do the show reel stuff doesn't feel like it's going to benefit me that much.
No.
Also because my focus is on the craft and the blacksmithing community, specifically in Norway, the world in general, but specifically in Norway. Like, that's the people I want to be recognized by. Yeah. Everybody else can just see a thing, think that's cool, and they can buy off the webpage. So they can get the normal newsletter. They can find me at markets, but I want to have a a relationship with other people who care about the crafts.
Oh, that's a good point to close.
It sounded too succinctly or something. It's scary now.
Well, you'd also across the point of the hour that I'd picked up said focus three times. So for those of you playing the setting up drinking game, we've got to be careful and limit how many ones on there. But equally, I think we've covered some good points, and hopefully people haven't been screaming at their headphones or radio or however they're listening to this too much with some of my waffle. But I think we've definitely covered some different angles on different types there where we, you know, marketing for events and liquidating and growth and all the rest of it, and different ways of doing things and different opinions and all the rest of that kind of thing. So for those of you who aren't already aware and doing a bit of targeted marketing ourselves, we are on Patreon, and I'm very bad at remembering to tell people that. It's currently very low bar, and at the moment, you're not necessarily getting any extra rewards for signing up to the Patreon, but it is contributing towards the cost of us continuing on with this podcast. We do intend doing some rewarded content at some point soon. We are having to fit this around all of our other lives, as is the case for many of us. So it will become more, and there will be merch. We keep saying this, there will be merch by January, I think is the current battle cry. so we need to work on that.
We try.
But yeah, so we are on Patreon. If people are willing to contribute a little bit to that, it would be greatly appreciated. But if not, if you just want to drop a line, if you just want to let us know what you think of the podcast, positive or negative, then please go to Setting Up Shop on Instagram, and that's shop shoppe, and it will have the same logo as the episodes of the podcast wherever you're listening to those. If you don't want to go to the Instagram to do it, if you have the functionality on your podcasting app, Spotify or otherwise, please leave a comment or review on there, particularly on Apple. That helps, gets us up charts and all kinds of things. Or if you just want to reach out and message any of us individually, then please. My Instagram is at bevelwooduk, all one word. You can find Heidi at Whitehall Pottery, and you can find Rasmus at Rasmus Lowen. Yeah, I'm getting there. It's fine. It's only taken 2.5 seasons. Next week's episode, we haven't fully decided on a topic yet, but we will do in time. I'm trying to remember what episode number this is now for this season.
This should be episode 6.
Episode 6. So we're coming close towards the end of this season, but we will be recording again in the new year unless something catastrophic happens. And we would always welcome thoughts on topics to cover, subjects we may want to discuss, or special guests who may have unique insight into this weird and wonderful world of ours that you think might be worth us interviewing. We've got another one in mind. We just need to work out timings to make it work for them as well, because they are exceptionally busy in their new business, which is amazing and lovely to see. But we don't want to take away from that just so that they can have a random chat. Anyway, that's it for this week. And thank you, everyone, for listening. Please tell your friends. Share it with as many people as you can. Bye.
Bye-bye. And Heidi doesn't want to say bye. That's fine.
Hello.
Hello.